And you're listening to WHUS 91.7 FM. I am Fran Storch, and you are listening to Radio Naturopath here on, today is November 16th, 2016.
That it is.
Yes. And so this is our date, and so if you're listening on podcast, it's probably not November 16th. Anyway, this is what was going on in the world at that time. So it's been a very interesting week. One of the things we'd love for you to do is we'd love for you to call in. You can call in at 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can also write us at radionaturopath@gmail.com. And you can also text us at 860-486-9487. All right. So any way you would like to get a hold of us, we would love for you to participate in the program with your opinions and ideas.
All of those things. Do you have questions about natural medicine? Do you have questions about your health? All the fun stuff.
Yeah. So anyways.
The doctor is in the house.
Doctor's in the house.
Yes.
So in any case, we've had an interesting week. You know, we have we have a new president-elect. It's very exciting. He's plotting and planning and putting together his cabinet, and he got interviewed on 60 Minutes, and that was all very interesting. And so it will be interesting to see what happens. And there was a lot going on from both sides. Those who elected him, it's very interesting. It seems like people really want change, and they're hoping that electing Donald Trump is going to provide change, that electing Hillary Clinton would have been more of the same old business as usual, and that people were going to continue to suffer with, I guess, higher taxes, not enough jobs, and bad health care. I guess that's what people were concerned about. And they're hoping that in Trump's America, is that what they're hoping for? That there's going to be more jobs and there's going to be more better health care and good gun rights? And I think that's what they're looking for. That's what people are hoping for. I think the big thing is
that's the idea.
I think the big thing is that it's the economy and that people feel that they're forgotten.
And
the other side of it is that there were laws that people feel like were presented to them that were not necessarily what they wanted. So things like gay marriage, there are people who are pro-choice who want abortion to be illegal. The whole issues with trans people being allowed to use the bathroom of their gender identity. These are all things that the liberal agenda happened too fast for a lot of people. So that's why a lot of people are upset. And if I'm not saying this right, please call in and let me know. That was my understanding. What I've heard people say who voted for Trump is that they're looking for change. They don't want a lot of the same. And my understanding is what's similar about the two candidates, the main thing that's similar is they are both interested in infrastructure change. But I don't know what that means. Policy-wise, I'm not sure what they're interested in. But apparently Trump has interested in creating jobs through improving infrastructure. But I'm not sure of any of the details of that. My concern is, and the other thing is that basically people who voted for Trump, if he said things that they don't agree with, and some of them, they don't agree with some of the rhetoric, the difficult rhetoric, like, you know, deporting millions of immigrants and, the Islamophobia and the homophobia. They're not in favor of that. They forgive him for saying whatever he needed to say to get elected. But my concern is that,
or doing whatever he had to do to get elected.
Yes. And what I'm seeing is that he's continuing to say whatever he needs to say to get what he's interested in. So it was very interesting because there was the 60 Minutes interview that Leslie Stahl did.
Mm-hmm.
And and from the sound bites that I saw, I didn't get a clear sense of where he is or what he's about.
I shouldn't comment on this. But that's been going on for years.
Right.
I just did. It's very hard to be a politician because, you know, you want everybody to vote for you, right?
Right.
And you want everybody to like you.
Yep.
And it's just not going to happen.
Yep.
You know, there's going to be people that say, no, absolutely not. I won't stand for that. I won't go for that. But, you know, you do need to get the attention of people. And unfortunately, there is a bad habit, I guess I'll call it, in politics, where you distort or sometimes twist the truth of what you're really going to do. So, you know, it's and it just doesn't happen overnight. It's not that easy. It's, you know, that's the issue with dealing with any organization of any kind, whether it be a political organization like our government, or whether it be a local organization. You're not going to get those things to happen overnight.
No.
There's a process that you have to go through. You know, I had a meeting at the House last night, you know, with Robert's Rules. You know, we have our process. We have our way of doing things to be able to get things done. And, you know, hopefully everybody pays attention to that and follows the rules and you get things done in an orderly fashion.
Right. And there are some people who are concerned that that the way Trump was speaking during the campaign, he had some very extreme beliefs. And the other concern they have is, for example, he's looking at Steve Bannon to be on his staff. And Steve Bannon is very far to the right, and he has a history of ties to the KKK and anti-Semitism. He didn't send his kids to a particular school because there are too many Jewish kids there. I mean, so there's some problems. So,
well, yeah, as there will be with anyone coming in to office.
Right. The process of him putting his staff together has been fraught with difficulty thus far. So that's interesting. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens. I mean, I could deal with a president who is not someone I agree with, and then to stand up for and fight for the things that I believe in. But I guess I have an underlying fear that something terrible is going to happen, that there's going to be something that goes on, like an international incident, or there's going to be a war that I don't want, and there's going to be nuclear war, and our infrastructure is going to be destroyed. And when I talk about working on the infrastructure as one of their goals, I'm talking about they're interested in fixing roads and bridges and tunnels and things like that. And I think both sides are interested in that. But in terms of something happening to the world, I'm just concerned that, you know, our way of life, that you're getting up and going to work in the morning and going to the store and all the normal things that you do, that's going to be taken away. Also very interesting was watching Cory Booker, who was on Meet the Press, and he was talking about how an election like this can be very damaging. There are certain people that it can be very directly damaging to, that if there are policies that take away social programs and that take away certain people's rights, it affects these people directly, and where they had help, they won't have help, and their lives will be much more difficult. So, you know, and that's going to go for people who are, you know, if you take away choice, a woman's right to have an abortion if she needs one, or you make it much, much more difficult for her to get one, there are going to be women who have children who don't want to, you know, and there are going to be women who, or women who have a pregnancy that they can't terminate, and they have a medical reason why they need to terminate it. Like they have toxemia, they have pregnancy-induced hypertension, which is life-threatening, and they won't be able to get them, or they're going to have to travel 1,000 miles to get one, so things like that. We don't understand. Like here, you live in the Northeast. Going to the next town means driving. Well, I do a run in the morning, and I run through three towns. When you get to big states like Texas and Oregon and California and Nevada, they're really big, and not every bit of the state is even a town, that you have unincorporated state lands. That's a thing we don't have in Connecticut. We mostly don't have in the Northeast. I don't know. Well, we might have it. Maybe there's that in Maine. I don't know.
There are some remote areas for sure.
But definitely are they unincorporated? We don't have any unincorporated land in Connecticut. We don't have any unincorporated land in New Jersey, although, I don't know about the Pine Barrens, if there's unincorporated land in the Pine Barrens, that if all of the Pine Barrens is spoken for or not municipally, but as in terms of breaking it into municipalities. But there are large swaths of land. I mean, I used to see that in when I lived in Portland, you can go outside the Portland city limits and you're in unincorporated Multnomah County. And you don't have that out here. So you have, so there are big stretches of area that people have to traverse to get from here to there. And if you make them cross state lines because they need a medical procedure, it could be a great hardship. And that's something that, you know, that people who have means don't understand. So, and if you live in a place where everything you need is right around you, where, you know, the worst thing about driving to New York, mm-hmm. you know, getting to New York is not, it's not that far, you know, that then you don't have those issues. So,
yeah.
So anyway, that's what was going on. I thought I'd throw that out because this week, you know, the last week we were in shock because of the results, and this week we're in a place where cooler heads prevail.
Right, and I think people are starting to calm down. But anyway, what do we have in the world of natural medicine? Anything exciting and new that we need to talk about? Is there anything out there on your radar?
Yeah, well, right before the election, I spent the weekend in New Hampshire, and I went to the National...
That's right, you did.
The New Hampshire Association of Naturopathic Doctors Conference, which is always a great conference. I always enjoy it.
Did you learn lots of good things?
I really did. And it's very nice to see my my cohorts. I don't often get to spend time with other naturopathic physicians, and I'd like to change that. I would love to spend more time with other naturopathic physicians, sharing ideas. It's always interesting to talk to other naturopaths to find out how they practice because everybody's different. Everybody has a different personality and everybody has different ideas. And you get two naturopaths in the room and they're going to have happened upon different bits of information. And sharing information is always a good thing as far as I'm concerned. And my first experience of this was when I was in school and I used to go to class with my friend Lori and we would both be taking notes. And sitting in class, having to take notes for a lecture for a long time, you start to fade in and out after a while. So what we would find is that Lori would catch things that I missed and vice versa. So it was always a good idea to share information. So that goes on later in life, too, that you find things that that somebody focused on, somebody happened upon, and you didn't. So you always get to share that information. So there was a lot of good stuff. So there was a doc called named Eric Dorninger who was very interesting, and he talked about biofilms. And these are not movies about biological issues.
They're not biographies either.
No. These biofilms are proteins that are made by microorganisms, and they can be made anywhere. They can be made in a dish wherever the microorganisms grow. They make a biofilm. So when you go into your shower and you slip on that icky stuff that's growing, part of
Ew,
what you're slipping
clean
on is
your shower.
Yeah, I know. Part of that is biofilm. Mm. So anyway, so microorganisms, especially bacteria, will make proteins and surround their colony with this protective protein layer. And so when your immune system is trying to attack the microorganisms, the biofilm can make it so that the immune system can't get to the microorganism. So biofilms can be really problematic. Often you wind up need, because they're proteins, you often need proteolytic enzymes to get rid of them. And also just, you know, if you can reach them, you have to clean out the muck. So it was very interesting. One of the things that what got presented to me was Marcon's. And Marcon's is, it's a resistant strain of coagulase negative staph aureus. So it's resistant to particular antibiotics and it makes a nasty biofilm. So there's a hormone called melanocyte stimulating hormone, and it stimulates your melanocytes to work, when melanocytes are the pigment cells in your body. But if you have low levels of this, it's usually associated with a higher susceptibility to this particular bacteria, the Staph aureus that hangs around and makes these biofilms. So you can test somebody for MSH, for melanocyte stimulating hormone, and if they have symptoms that you want to take care of, like they have chronic sinusitis or chronic rhinitis or allergies, and they have low MSH, you might want to treat them for Marcon's. You can also just do a swab for Marcon's, and it's what you do is you get this... this swab that's really, really skinny, and you have to take a sample of the person's nasal mucosa. So this really skinny swab, it goes deep into the sinuses when you do the test. So I've done it before, and it's a special sinus swab where...
How deep?
Well, you know, whereas if I was just going to do a basic culture, I have swabs that are basically the size of your average Q-tip.
Okay.
And although they're like a long Q-tip, and they're, right. You know, I'm not sure how many millimeters to say. So like a basic Q-tip is going to be half a millimeter wide, whereas, or not half a millimeter, half a centimeter wide, whereas these swabs are much thinner. They're going to be more like a millimeter wide. They're very skinny, and the swab itself is very narrow. So you can push it past the turbinates and deeper into the sinuses. It's not very comfortable, and you're going to make the person screw up their nose and sneeze, but you can get deeper into the sinus to get something on the swab that you can then send off and culture. And you can culture somebody for Marcon's too. It's just that you have to send it to a specialty lab to do it. And so if you find that the person has this, there are things that can kill it. And one of the things is they talked about was sovereign silver or silver hydrosol. So people like to use silver, and I haven't been a big fan of silver in terms of a lot of people like to use colloidal silver. So colloidal silver is it's silver that's been created in a sort of, not exactly a solution, I suppose it's a silver colloid, but it's silver particles, silver nanoparticles that have been suspended in water. And when you get silver particles suspended in that way, it can be a great antimicrobial. There is a practice of placing silver nitrate drops into babies' eyes when they're born to get the bacteria from the birth canal out of the baby's eyes. So silver is a great antimicrobial. So if you use a silver hydrosol, the parts per million of silver is a lot lower. So it's just a fine particle solution of silver, and it's antimicrobial, supposedly. Anyway, so it's been found to be helpful against Marcon's. So if you have a suspicion that someone has Marcon's, the thing is, using silver hydrosol silver hydrosol is very benign. I mean, when you use the silver hydrosol, you're going to feel like you're just putting a bit of water up your nose. It's not a big deal. You're just going to feel like you're using a benign nasal spray. So even if you didn't get tested, like if you have chronic sinusitis or rhinitis, and you know, your nose is just plugged all the time, it wouldn't be the end of the world, in my estimation, if you went and got some silver hydrosol and used it without being tested for MSH or Marcon's. However, if you have the ability to get tested for either of those things, it might be a nice thing, because then you know what you're dealing with and you have to be a little more aggressive with your treatment. So if you got the Marcon's in your nose anyway, then it's quite likely that you got other things up there too. This is a great conversation, I know.
This is a lovely conversation.
I know, but you know what? How many people do you know with sinusitis and look in the mirror?
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. Yeah. Oh, no. I know. I definitely know.
Well, you and I have some things that we need to do, and I'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
So if you're a chronic sinusitis person, there can be a lot of things going on. And here's a shout out to President-elect Trump. Are you ready for this?
I'm waiting.
You got to drain the swamp.
Oh.
It's all true. Yes.
I can't believe you went there.
I went there.
You went there.
Totally went there. And it's also a shout out to my beloved teacher, who I had a great lecture from while I was at the conference, Richard Tom. He gave a great lecture. And he said that. He said that you have to, you can address the organism or you can treat the terrain. And when you treat the terrain, if you drain the swamp, you're not going to have swamp gas, right? So if you're upset because, you know, the back of your house has a swamp in it and you've got problems from the swamp, like you have, what are some problems from a swamp? One is that you're going to have swamp gas and it's stinky. But other things are it could breed mosquitoes and therefore disease or Zika virus or whatever. So if you drain this, so you could kill the, you could get, you could get pesticides to kill the mosquitoes, right?
Right.
Or you could just drain the swamp. right? Well, okay. This applies to the body, too. If you have a setup in the body that makes it more amenable to microorganisms, then you're going to have more microorganisms. So when you have a chronic inflammatory condition, and right now we're focusing on sinusitis, you have to approach it from a multifactorial. You have to think about what are all the things that are causing it. And this is very, very basic. This is what I love about going to these conferences. It reminds me of why I love naturopathic medicine and why our medicine is so effective. It's because you get to look at what's going on from all different perspectives. It's not just one thing. It's not just you have a microorganism, let's kill it. You can't do that because if you have the conditions that the microorganism can thrive in, it's just going to come back. That's how it works. So repeat courses of antibiotics are useless. And I'm not saying you should never use antibiotics, because if you use antibiotics and you also drain the swamp, you might get some good results. Now, I prefer to use other antimicrobials because it's hard, for example, for a microorganism to become resistant to silver hydrosol. It can't figure out how to get it because the mechanism that the silver goes after it it's not a biological entity. So it's not like the silver can it's not like the microorganisms can develop silver-resistant bacteria that are not going to respond to the silver. Because the silver gets in, it becomes part of the life cycle of the cell, and the cell just can't work. And that's not going to go away. It's that likewise salt. You can't have salt-resistant bacteria. If you put enough salt into a solution, everything's going to blow up because of osmosis. That's why there's nothing in the Dead Sea. What's in the Dead Sea? What lives in the Dead Sea?
Salt. Nothing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Because it's all salty.
And it's very simple. It's osmotic. You have a hyperosmotic solution. You have a supersaturated solution such that a microorganism gets in there and fluid travels from an area of low concentration to an area of high concentration through a semipermeable membrane. That's the law of osmosis, right? So if you have a cell, which there's all cells of any kind have less salt per unit volume in it than the Dead Sea does. So the fluid's coming out of that membrane fast, and it's going to go, you know, what happens to a slug when you put salt on it?
Not good.
Bad stuff,
bye-bye,
right?
Bye-bye slug.
Well, that's what happens when you put microorganisms into a very salty solution. So that's why there's nothing in the Dead Sea. So when you clean your nose out with salt, you're going to kill pretty much everything that's in there.
Yeah.
Anything that can get to it is going to die.
And what's the tea tree oil do?
Tea tree oil, too. Well, tea tree oil is an antimicrobial, and it has...
Because that's another thing that we do.
Yes. Well, tea tree oil has that's a great idea. That's a great question. What is the mechanism of action of essential oils? And I think what it is, that is a really good question. How does thymol work? How do the terpenes work? How does thujone and thujine work? All these constituents that are antimicrobial that are in essential oils. I don't know that they may breach the cell membranes of the bacteria. I don't actually know what the mechanism of action is.
Well, that's one you can work on.
But one of the things about essential oils and being antimicrobial is that if you have, say, pick your favorite essential oil, or even pick something, one of my recent favorite things ever, black seed oil. So you have black seed oil, black cumin seed oil. You have, pick a few antimicrobial ones. Thuja oil, red cedar oil, great antimicrobial. How about tea tree oil, eucalyptus, thyme oil? All of those things are terrific antimicrobials. Peppermint oil even has antimicrobial properties, right? So all of those things have many, many constituents in them. So even if bacteria was going to decide to become resistant to one of those, there's another constituent right behind it that's going to go after it. So because there's so many constituents, they're very rich substances, you're not going to get antibiotic resistance in general to essential oils. And then if you use multiple essential oils, even better, because all of the essential oils have different properties. Sage oil, that's another one. I was reading about sage oil last night, particularly Dalmatian sage oil. And Dalmatian sage oil has a lot of similar stuff to what red cedar oil has in it. It's got the thujines and thujones and terpenes and a lot of same stuff, and similar to Tea Tree Oil's got a lot of those similar things. They have slightly different profiles, and that's why they smell different and look different and taste different and like that. So anyway, so getting back to this sinusitis. So if you have this Marcon's, you got a few things going on. You have the Marcon's loves to make biofilm. So you have to clean out the biofilm. And if you use the silver hydrosol, it can get at the biofilm as well. But you like we said, you have to drain the swamp. So what is so when you're talking about a person with an infection, what is the swamp? So the swamp is usually some version of inflammation. So how did the inflammation get there? And that's what you have to look at. The body, so unfriendly bacteria can't exist in a vacuum. They have to have the right conditions to have that happen. So if you're going to get Marcon's, so one of the things that happens in a nose is mold. And everybody has mold in their nose. That's been studied. So there was a great study that was done a number of years ago at the Mayo Clinic where they cultured the noses of people with chronic sinusitis and a sampling of people without. And guess what? Everybody had mold in their nose. The people with chronic sinusitis were divided into a group. One group had allergies to the mold, and the other group had an immune reaction to the mold that could not be defined as an allergy. So one of the things we know about mold is when it's in and around your body's cranking at it, and it's trying to mount an immune response. But it's very hard for the body to mount an immune response against a specific mold, which is why molds and fungi, things in the fungal world, they just survive so well. They're just really well protected from things that can attack them. Whereas if you have a virus, you have a cold virus, right?
Okay.
If you have a cold virus, your lymphocytes will look at it, and your lymphocytes actually can chemically encode so that they can go after the virus in a lock and key fit. They know how to do that. They look at it and go, all right, this is what this is the mechanism it looks like. And they program your DNA to make an antibody, to turn that cell into an antibody that will specifically fight that virus. And then it fits in the virus with a lock and key fit and it kills it. How cool is that? Can't really do that with mold. What you get is more humoral responses, non-specific immune responses. So you get your macrophages active, you get your eosinophils active, you get different cells active that are going to, well, eosinophils, they leave the circulation, they become mast cells, and they degranulate, but they don't specifically encode themselves. That's not true, because you can have IgE antibodies to specific items. So I misspoke. That's not true. That you will have mast cells that are encoding themselves to fight specific allergens. But they don't always do that. If you have a situation where you have a microorganism that your body's just not making, it's not encoding yourself against that, mold is really good at hiding from the immune system. So your immune system is always cranking, and it's sending a nonspecific response. And it's always active, and it doesn't let up. And so you've got this long-standing, tired, overworked immune system. And so one of the things you have to do, yeah, you can address the organism, and I like addressing the organism with natural substances because, again, the organisms, we have a few antifungal drugs which you can use, but things like essential oils and silver hydrosol and salt are very effective. So why not use them? And there's ways to get them up into your nose. So silver hydrosol is very easy. You can buy nasal sprays that have silver hydrosol and just use them. So they're easy to squirt up your nose. You can get nasal sprays that you can just purchase that are all ready-made, and they've got grapefruit seed extract in them, and they've got tea tree oil in them. And they're very easy to use. Again, you just squirt them in your nose, and they'll kill whatever's in there. You can also use your neti pot. And the nice thing about using the neti pot is, again, you're using the neti pot with sea salt, and you're using a hypersaline solution. So the hypersaline solution is going to go in there and try to kill whatever's in there. And if you use a little bit of essential oil. Now, essential is very potent, and so when you're doing a neti pot, I recommend no more than 1 to 2 drops of whatever essential oil you're using.
Right, I just use like a drop in my neti pot when I do it.
And that's plenty.
Boy, tea tree oil is also great for, it's great for mold.
Yes, it is.
It's a mold thing.
Yes,
too.
It is. It's
so
a
if you have
terrific
mold in
antifungal.
Your nose, then yes. That's the good thing to use.
That's right. It's a terrific antifungal.
Yeah,
it's
great for a lot of things. I have a whole list of stuff.
Chances
here.
Are you have mold in your nose, so you might as well use it unless
that's what
you're
I was
allergic
say.
To it.
I mean, if you're allergic to mold, you probably have some in your nose, right?
No. You have mold in your nose. If you're alive, you have mold in your nose.
Oh, really?
Unless you're the boy in the bubble. Seriously.
Oh, yeah, we're not that.
I'm saying
not
that
in our house.
Everyone, that's what the Mayo Clinic study showed. It said that showed that everyone has mold in their nose.
Yeah.
It's just that some people have an allergic reaction to it. Some people have a reaction to it that's an immune reaction but not an allergy. And then other people are just not reacting to it. But it's always there. Why? Because mold is in the environment. And
okay.
Not only that, you have hundreds of species of mold in your nose. That's
so
the other
it
exciting
bad
thing.
To have those in your nose? Because I know that like there's some bacteria that are good to have in your body. But
that's
then,
right.
What's the story there?
There's not too much probiotic mold. There is a probiotic yeast that's Saccharomyces boulardii, which means there are probably other probiotic yeasts. And are there probiotic molds in your nose? That is a really good question. Molds are usually commensals. And they stay commensal unless the conditions in the swamp become right for them, and then they become pathogenic. So you have symbiotic, you have probiotic, things that are probiotic, and probiotics by definition are symbiotic. Symbiotic means that there is a synergy between the living organism, the host organism, and the living organism. So a probiotic by definition is something that you provided a great place to live, and in exchange it does wonderful things for you. So it'll keep the bad guys at bay, it reduces inflammation, it makes vitamins for you, it's antimicrobial, makes immune compounds, does a lot of wonderful things for you. That's what a probiotic is. And a probiotic can be a yeast and it can be a bacteria. So yes, we have probiotic bacteria on every surface in our bodies that communicates with the outside world. So that means your entire digestive system from end to end, and your respiratory system, and your skin, and for our genital tract as well. Men don't have so much, they don't have too much going on in their genital tracts. They're not supposed to, it's supposed to basically be sterile. So then you have commensals. Commensals are organisms that just kind of hang. They're squatters. They live there because it's a good place to live. They don't particularly do anything for you. They're just kind of there. Commensals can stay commensal. Some commensals, when the situation is right, they will become pathogenic. And then you have pathogens. Pathogens can be, usually you use the word pathogen for any organism that is hurtful to you. So, if you have a pathogen can be a parasite. And so we usually use the word parasite for either multicellular organisms that live off of us. And you can have unicellular parasites. They're usually in the protozoan family. So something like a paramecium or an amoeba is one cellular, and it's considered to be a parasite as opposed to a bacteria because it's a different structure than a bacteria. When you say a bacteria that's hurting you, you don't use the word parasite. You use the word pathogen or pathogenic bacteria. That's just how that works. So you have your nose. So when you're doing those things where you're cleaning your nose, you're using the salt, you're doing a couple things. You're doing a little bit of swamp draining, but you're mostly addressing the organism. And how you're doing the swamp draining is because when you do salt in your nose, you're sending a hyper saline solution in there, and it's a higher rate of salinity than the lining of your nose. So the inflammation that's in your nose is going to be reduced because you're going to pull fluid out of the swollen linings of your nose. Because what did I say? Fluid travels from an area of low concentration to an area of high concentration across a semipermeable membrane. The semipermeable membrane is the lining of your nose. So the fluid will move from the lining of your nose into the hypersaline solution. And so that's how you help the microbes. So now if you want to drain the swamp, as what we're talking about here, you're talking about other ways to reduce inflammation. So another thing you have to do is you have to decide, are there things coming into the body that are creating inflammation? And one of the things you have to look at is the environment. Is the person living in an environment where there's things in the environment that are affecting them? And what is external irritant numero uno? That would be dust. And why dust? Because dust, it's not actually the dust itself, it's the dust mites. So dust mites, what they do is we are part of their life cycle. So dust mites will eat your skin cells because that's what they like to eat. They eat your skin cells. So they live off of you. They live off of skin cells that are sloughed off of us, and they eat them. Then they poop. And then they have, and their poop is combined with, their poop is made of DNA, protein, and bacteria. And all of that stuff is very antigenic, which means it's irritating to the immune system. And it's probably the most, what I see in my patients is that's the thing that people are the most allergic to. So it's the most antigenic substance, in part because it's just really antigenic, because it is. And also because we're overexposed to it. We're exposed to it over and over and over. It's the thing we're the most exposed to. Why? Because they live in us. They're part of our life cycle. You generally don't see people with raging antibodies like you do to dust, to anything else. Cats, dogs, trees, flowers, weeds, doesn't matter. You can see remarkable allergies to those things, but usually dust is dust, and worse than foods. Like when you do the antigens to foods, the foods are not a big deal compared to the dust, even though people can have really bad reactions to foods. But the amount of antibodies that I see to dust is tremendous. Oh, yes.
Dust is the bad boy.
Yeah, I'm allergic to dust.
So clean your house a lot.
Yeah, that's what you have to do. I definitely have a dust allergy. I tested myself. I did IgE allergens, and I'm definitely allergic to dust. I'm very slightly allergic to dairy. So I have a slight IgE allergy to dairy, which is why we really have to talk about should we really be eating dairy, because I continue to eat dairy. And then I have a slight allergy to alternaria mold, a specific mold. That was the only one.
What is alternaria mold?
It's a really common mold that's found in the environment. If we went home and cultured our house, we have some.
Everywhere. Probably in the leaves on the ground right now, too. Huh?
I'm not sure if it's a leaf mold.
There's a lot of mold outside right now.
That's right. So
we have rotting leaves.
That's right. So mold is definitely an issue. So draining the swamp, one of the things you have to do is you have to look around your house and go, do we have dust? And cleaning your house of dust is tough because what breeds dust? Clutter. And also not having time to clean your house, which if you're a hardworking person, you often don't. So you have a couple ways to deal with that. And one is that you get the whole family on board and you do some dust abatement regularly. The big thing about with dust is the bed. The bed is ground zero for dust, and the ground zero of ground zeros is your pillow. So if you can keep your pillows clean, that can go a long way towards reducing your dust situation. So if you're getting washable pillows or getting dust covers for your pillows that you clean regularly and changing out your pillowcases 2 to 3 times a week, even if you did nothing else, that would probably help a lot because those pillows are big residues for the big places where the dust can just hang out.
So how often should you change your pillows?
Change your pillows.
Or should you wash your pillows? Or what do you do
if
with your
you
pillows?
Can, that's what I said. You can get washable pillows.
You can.
You can get washable pillows. You can also get dust covers for your pillows. And
right.
So if the pillows are encased in this dust cover, then you can wash the dust covers. So if it's a plastic dust cover, you just wipe it down. And if it's a cloth dust cover, then you wash the dust cover. And that way you're not dealing with, you're not getting, so the dust cover is impervious to the dust. The dust just sits on it and then you wash it off and you're not imbuing this pillow constantly with dust mites. I mean, we have a lot of work that we can do around this.
Well, I'm sure, because I wake up in the morning and I'm stuffy.
Well, we may want to just do pillow. We might just want to go to the store and just buy all washable pillows and just get all new pillows and get washable ones and then make an effort to wash them regularly.
Right.
Because we have some really old pillows.
Yes, we do.
Yeah. So that might be a thing that we should consider.
I just don't know how often people change their pillows.
Yeah, no, I know. And if you have allergy problems, it's a good idea to either to change them or, like I said, get washable ones. And when you wash them, you wash them until they wear out. And I'm not sure how long they will last, washable pillows. So, and then changing your sheets and changing your bedding, changing your sheets at least once a week, and then taking your bedding and washing it as frequently as is convenient for you. And you'll find, like, if you just do rehab on your bed, like, just go home tonight and do your pillowcases, do your sheets, and do all your bedding, you probably wake up a little less stuffed up tomorrow morning. It really does make a difference. You know, and in our house, I try to wash our bedding, you know, when I think of it, maybe once a month. It's probably, if you have a lot of allergies, it's probably a good idea to do less. So there's that. So then you get the HEPA filter. HEPA filters are a great thing because you can turn the HEPA filter on and it will filter dust out of your house. And that can be a really nice thing. A room that has a HEPA filter in it can be... A room that has a HEPA filter in it it's really amazing because it'll pull the dust out of the air and it really can clear up the air and make the air much more breathable. The other thing is to not have carpets in your house. You can get rid of carpets. That's a great thing. Carpets are just an incredible seat for dust and mold and because you walk on them and you track them all the time. If you can't get rid of your carpets, then you want to be vacuuming and occasionally steam cleaning. So doing abatement of dust and mold in your house, that's one of the ways to reduce that sinusitis. And then there's doing the draining the swamp within yourself. And so that's where you have to look at, are you consuming foods that are inflammatory? And food number one for inflammation and feeding unfriendly bacteria is going to be sugar. So whether you are gluten intolerant or dairy intolerant or intolerant to this or that, sugar, really, number one, if you spend a few days not eating sugar, you may find that your sinusitis gets a lot better, even if you don't do so much cleaning in your house. So sugar causes inflammation, and it raises your insulin. When your insulin is higher, it stimulates more inflammatory compounds, and you just have inflammation in various places. The other thing is that sugar will feed unfriendly bacteria and microorganisms. So, you know, just reducing or eliminating sweets can be a great way to treat your sinusitis. And then you look at other things that are common allergens and, you know, too big. Now, if you're eating processed food is going to be depleted in nutrients, no matter what it's made out of. But gluten, grains, and dairy, you know, so one of the things is if you have mold, and if you have chronic sinusitis, no doubt you have issues with mold. And so if you look at Richie Shoemaker's work, he's the guy who did the work on biotoxins and mold, and, you know, also tick-borne illness, but anyway, biotoxins in general. When he's talking about helping you to clear mold toxins, he talks about the low amylose diet, which is basically a low starch diet and low sugar too. So low starch means, grains and avoiding grains. And that tends to help. And then some people are allergic to dairy, and dairy definitely. Now, your singers, anybody, I've had a couple of patients come in who are singers, and they come in and they know that dairy causes them to have more mucus. So even if they do eat dairy, they won't eat it right before a performance because they know it's going to produce more mucus for them. And so they're going to stay away from it to reduce the mucus. This is not about whether they care if they're allergic to it or not. It's a cause and effect thing. When I eat dairy before my performance, I have more mucus.
Right.
I don't want to have mucus on my vocal cords because I got to sing.
Right.
So they have
Makes sense.
Yeah. So they have a time period before their performances. And then some singers just don't do dairy because they have to sing all the time.
Right. Right.
Because they don't need anything that's inflaming your... I mean, when you're a singer, you're at risk of vocal injury all the time, and you're constantly trying to sing in such a way that you don't harm your voice. And harming the voice means harming the larynx, and certainly consuming anything that causes inflammation can give you... it can harm your voice. So finding out what foods don't work for you. So finding out what foods don't work for you. So you can do food allergy testing, and you can do testing by skin prick. You can do testing by blood. You can do testing of different antibody systems. If you get a test back where you seem to be allergic to everything, then The test may be less useful. Well, and that's when you have to not only do a hypoallergenic diet, but you have to heal the terrain.
You have to live in the bubble with the boy.
No, not necessarily. What you
to
have
everything?
To do, well, if you're, what you do is you wind up, you take out the most inflammatory foods.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, for some people, those are going to be gluten. I mean, if you're trying to reduce mold, if somebody has chronic sinusitis and you're trying to reduce mold, you're going to be looking at starch, unfortunately. So that's all your starchy foods. That's
grains and sugars.
Grains and sugars and starchy root vegetables, too.
Yeah.
So you take those out, and that's going to go a long way towards that the mold is not going to be able to eat. It's not going to have anything to eat, so it's going to die, and you'll have less inflammation that way. And then dairy is a common mucogenic allergen, and you can take that out. But if you find out, if you do the test and you're allergic to lots and lots of things, then sometimes, so if the body's cranking with immune stuff, it might be a good idea to take out, unfortunately, nuts and seeds. Some people do fine with nuts and seeds and some don't. But if you're making antibodies to them, it might be a good idea to take them out. And then you address the terrain. And what you do is the gut is likely breached. And so if there's that much inflammation going on, you're looking at the gut being breached. You have an increase in the zonulin pathway. And when you have the zonulin pathway, unfortunately, zonulin, when it gets stimulated in your digestive system, it breaks down the tight junctions between the villi, those little finger-like projections where you absorb your food in the small intestine.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start absorbing compounds that you're not supposed to. And that's how you appear to be allergic to everything. So then you try to take out the biggest offenders, grain sugars and dairy, and possibly nuts and seeds if that seems to be a problem for you. And then you consume things that can heal the gut lining. And that's where you put glutamine on board. And you can do glutamine by taking glutamine powder. You can get glutamine powder. It's almost tasteless, mildly sweet, and you can put it into anything. It doesn't really taste like anything. And it's lovely for helping to heal the gut lining. And then bone broth. Bone broth is incredible. Bone broth is the reason to make bone broth is to heal the gut lining. That's the main. I mean, it'll heal lots of other things too because it's got very absorbable collagen in it. It's got all the material you need in it to regenerate cells, which is why bone broth is so great. So if you consume bone broth, you send that down, and the bone broth is going to get into the digestive system and all the places where the body needs to heal. It's going to grab onto all those nutrients, the collagen, the stem cells, all the substances that are inside the cells, and it's going to make new cells and rebuild the gut lining. And then if you send down glutamine, you can do it by way of powder. Also, there's a lot of glutamine in sauerkraut, in cabbage. So cabbage, if you distress cabbage, poor cabbage, if you distress it in any way by cooking it, even better is to ferment it because then you get Lactobacillus brevis, which is what lives on cabbage, and that's a wonderful probiotic. And then when you ferment the cabbage by making it into sauerkraut, you make the glutamine that's inside the leaves more bioavailable. You can also drink cabbage juice, which, yum, right?
That just sounds about as, well, no, you know me.
Which is why it's a good idea to make sauerkraut.
Probably
to get some good organic sauerkraut that's live and still fermenting. You can purchase it from someone else, or you can make it yourself. All you have to do is you beat up on the cabbage. You cut up the cabbage and you beat up on it. You put some salt on it. And then you put it in a container and you let it sit for 2 weeks. And then you have sauerkraut.
Yeah, just none of it really has ever appealed to me.
I love sauerkraut. I really like it. You know, it's kind of salty and it's kind of sour.
I know. You like things that are... You like things I don't.
Yeah.
There's no question
about
that.
Well, everybody likes
things. Everybody does. Yeah,
everybody likes things that other people don't.
Yeah.
But see, so eating fermented foods have good quality probiotic in them in their own environment. So I like to encourage people to eat live foods, like your fermented, whatever you like to eat. Sauerkraut is a great idea if you have a gut problem because it does have the bioavailable glutamine that's going to help you heal your gut. And then you have the Lactobacillus brevis, which is also a great probiotic. So that's a particularly good one if you have digestive stuff. In fact, Robert's formula, you know how I give you that RF plus when you have a tummy ache?
Mm-hmm.
RF stands for Robert's formula, and Robert's formula is an old nature cure. Yeah, it's an old nature cure for the digestive system that has, depending on who's making, well, I think there was a traditional Robert's formula, but it has stuff like slippery elm, and one of the items in Robert's formula is echinacea, as golden seal, but it also has cabbage in it. It'll either have, usually has cabbage powder in it, and the cabbage is in there for the glutamine. So if you like cabbage, better to eat it cut up or juiced or fermented or steamed or cooked, because you want the leaves to be at least somewhat distressed so you can crunch into them or get inside them, because that's where the glutamine is. So if you're going to have cabbage in your salad and you're eating it raw, it's a good idea to shred it and shred it pretty fine so that you can chew on it, or even, you know, micro shred, like food processor shred it, so it's you'll get more benefit from it, because you're going to have more exposure of the cell walls. You know, okay. you can get coleslaw you can get it where it's stringy, you know, in that the classic stringy coleslaw form, right? And you can also get it where it's chopped finely. Right. That's probably a better way if you're trying to get at the glutamine. That's probably a better way to go. Yeah. So
okay.
I like coleslaw. Like coleslaw?
I like coleslaw.
No.
I like coleslaw. Coleslaw is good.
We need to take a cabbage and beat it up. All right. So that's draining the swamp. And then you can take things that reduce inflammation. You can take curcumin. You can eat turmeric. There was a really funny thread on Facebook. My beloved old choir director and drama teacher, I'm Facebook friends with him, and he's very precise. I can see how his mind works, and I have a great appreciation for him at this point in life, because I'm not, you know, this wide-eyed teenager looking up to him. Now I see him as a human on an equal footing. And I've gotten insight into how his mind works and why he was so great as a choir director as well as a drama director, that he has a great ability to see how things fit together. And he has, he has that same thing that I have in terms of precision with words, where, you know, if you say turmeric, I'm like, oh, you said turmeric.
It's turmeric.
You got it.
Right.
Yeah, so he complained on Facebook about how people say turmeric. People, it's turmeric, not turmeric. Okay. And I thought, I just died laughing. It's so funny. So we had a whole string about how people make malapropisms, how they say the wrong word for the wrong, or they pronounce things wrong, and it was very funny. And then he got a little sad because people were like, lighten up. And I'm like, no, don't lighten up. Oh, this is hysterical thread.
Some people have too much time on their hands.
Well, I thought it was really funny. And I said, I really appreciated the thread because I'm exactly the same way.
You are. I know.
I am. Mm. And, you know, you have to, be careful, because like when your brain works that way, you have to choose when you're going to say something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you become annoying.
And oh, I wouldn't want to be annoying.
No, not you, me.
Oh, you.
I have the potential to be annoying.
Oh, you have the potential to be annoying.
Because I hear someone say turmeric and I want to correct them.
There are three correct answers in life.
Yes, no, and three.
That's correct.
Yes.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, it's so.
It's an inside story.
So in terms of being polite, if somebody says turmeric to me, I'm probably not going to correct them.
Mm.
If somebody says I'm going to take turmeric to help my prostrate, probably not going to correct them.
Yeah, there you go.
You know,
that's funny. That's very funny.
But people say that, and you just go, yeah, you know. And if they,
well, you know what they're talking about.
I know. And if there's a lighter way to connect it. Now, the other thing that people mash up in my office are the names of pharmaceuticals, but you can.
That's not a difficult thing to do.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
My God, look at all the crazy names that are out
there. That's right. They're all like made up words, and you don't even know why they made them up the way they made them up.
It's a marketing thing.
Yeah. But like metoprolol, I don't even know if that's the right way to say it. It's if it's metoprolol or metoprolol, I'm not sure. but it's a very commonly prescribed beta blocker. So I get to hear people metoprolol. I've heard it all. Yeah, it's really funny. So I only even got to talk about one aspect because it was very interesting, because chronic sinusitis is kind of a big deal. And this is the thing about naturopathic medicine, which is why our medicine is so rich. When you have chronic sinusitis, chronic sinusitis is a harbinger. And what I mean by that is it's a sign that you have inflammation in general going on in your body. It just happens to be that the sinusitis is very obvious to you. And it's particularly annoying. But if you have sinusitis, you have inflammation in general in your body. So the things that you want to do is you want to address the organism by doing things like using a neti pot. The neti pot ought to have salt water in it. It can have essential oils. And if it's possibly Marcon's, you can test for MSH. You can test for Marcon's itself. And silver hydrosol will kill it. And possibly also nasal sprays with grapefruit seed extract and tea tree oil. So that's one thing to do. And then the other thing to do is to provide the body with good, healthy gut flora by doing fermented foods and perhaps taking probiotics, and also helping to rebuild the gut lining by taking things like glutamine, using herbs like marshmallow root and slippery elm to provide mucilage to heal the gut lining, and also to do bone broth. But bone broth is a very rich source of all the things you need to rebuild a lot of tissues in your body, especially the digestive system, but also your bones and joints. So if you have arthritis, bone broth is a great idea. Okay. And then the other thing is to clean your environment. Do the best you can in terms of abating your house of dust and mold by addressing it with HEPA filters, getting out rugs, and especially taking care of the bedroom and the bedding. And like I said, ground zero for dust mites is your pillow. So paying attention to the pillows can be a really big thing.
So in the future, we had a caller calling from Pawcatuck.
Oh, I used to live there.
Yeah. And they hear us on the radio all the way down there.
That's fantastic.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So they would like us to do a show, pillow show, on types of pillows and maintenance of pillows.
Oh.
And so we're going to do some research on that. I told the caller that we would do that and get back.
Well, research on pillows. What's the best pillows for the different? Because there's different reasons to get a pillow. Neck support, allergenicity.
Right.
All different kinds of reasons.
And as I looked at this, I thought we could spend a lot of a show on this.
Then
another thing we should do is we should talk about the oils. There's like five essential oils that are very important. I'm sure there's more, but there seem to be five big ones.
Right.
And we should talk more about that.
Okay.
So.
All right.
From the callers that are out there listening, thank you very much for your input.
Yeah, you bet. So this is our second to last show before Thanksgiving. So next week we'll talk about perhaps some Thanksgiving stuff.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so you're listening to 91.7 FM WHUS Doors. I am Fran Storch. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath for the last hour. And we will be back next week with more Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM.